Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intercept, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and I welcome today. We are talking with former soccer player, coach, and author whose new book, Play On, traces 140 years of women's soccer and the long fight for equality that ran beside it. From the 1880s to today, women athletes have faced ridicule, exclusion, and even violence, yet have built a legacy of perseverance and power. Heidi Smith spoke to coaches, players, sports journalists, and other experts to trace the history of women's soccer and its parallel to social, political, and women's rights movements worldwide. We'll explore how the game of soccer mirrors the continuing struggle for women's rights, equity, and inclusion. Heidi, welcome to 411 Teen. So glad to have you.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
How did the women's soccer get started, for those of us who didn't really know, in the late 19th century? Can you share some history? I'd like us to kind of go over a little history so we'll know, people like me will know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So there is one story that I didn't include in the book, which says that even before that, like somewhere in the 1700s, that in the Scottish town of Inverness, that men would actually pick their wives by hosting a soccer game where the women were playing. But that may just be a myth. I don't know. But,
okay. That's interesting to know, though.
But in the 1880s in England, that was really kind of the first attempt for women to break into the game. And there were some clubs that formed, but unfortunately, at that point, they were really met with a lot of resistance and even a degree of violence. Mm. So they lasted until, I think it was about 1896, and then went underground until post-World War I.
Okay. What drew you personally to uncovering the history and writing your new book, Play On?
A couple of things. I think on kind of an intellectual level, I'm a former history teacher, and I'm also a former player and coach. And I was interested in the intersection of those things. But when I went looking for that history, what I really found was that there were a lot of YA books that had been written about it. Mm-hmm. And then there were a number of books that really were looking at specific eras in history. So post-World War I in England has been written about quite a bit. And the U.S. Women's National Team has had entire books written about it. But if I wanted to find something that was comprehensive, both in terms of geography and time, it mm-hmm. just didn't really exist. And then on a more personal level, I just knew from my playing and coaching days, I know the power of this game. It's an incredibly powerful sport for young girls and young women and women, period, to play. It gives us a chance to express ourselves physically in ways that I think we're not always allowed societally. Mm-hmm. And I just always felt like there is more to this game. The fact that it is the most popular sport in the world means that it has power to create change beyond the sport itself. And once I started really looking at that, I found that that was absolutely the case.
Well, you spoke with players and coaches and journalists, and through all of those interviews and conversations, what story or discovery surprised you the most?
That is a good question. I think some of the things that surprised me were just about what's happening right now that I had kind of heard about in the news, but I hadn't really looked into. And just for example, like right now in Iran, women have finally been allowed into stadiums to watch the game somewhat. They're still in, they have their own special sections where they're allowed to sit, but it's usually just a very small number of tickets. But right up until like 2019, women in Iran were not allowed into stadiums at all. And so you had these young women and girls in their teens trying to get into stadiums, dressing up like men, getting arrested, getting beaten, being sent to the worst prison in the country. And that's, you know, this is modern, and it's just kind of shocking that that would still be happening in this day and age. And then other things surprise me too, because like I think of Germany as a fairly progressive country, and it's a country that has won, that the German women's national team has won the World Cup twice. They've won the European Championship, I think, 8 times, maybe 10. Sorry, Germany, if I'm getting that wrong. But they, even like back in the 80s, they had to do bake sales to fund their national team at the time, like the equivalent of their national team. And their national federation told them they should really be in the kitchen. And this was recent, and they still don't have equal pay. That just the things in Germany have not progressed to nearly the degree that I thought they would have, and the history there is also less progressive than I had expected. And so that was interesting. I'm trying to think of some positive examples to share with you because
Well, there's
it's all,
plenty
you
of
know.
negatives. I can see that. I remember that from reading the book. But it was very well done. Your book was very well done and very informative and very enlightening for those like me who knew very little. Okay.
Oh,
So
thank
I
you.
want to, yeah. And it seemed like, now maybe I got this wrong, that the British Football Association ban was a turning point that kind of drew, it drove the decision. Would you agree, or did I just misread that?
That the FA ban drove the decision, which the,
Well,
sorry, I'm just trying to.
there were. It's the one that was a turning point that changed everything.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah. It changed everything in England. So what was happening right after World War One is that women's football, as it's called in England, had become incredibly popular. There was a team called Dick Kerr's Ladies that they were like the superstars of their day. They were like celebrities. They had like 53,000 fans at one of their games. And they were on newsreels and they traveled around and they were hugely popular. And this was really seen as a threat, not just them, but other women's teams as well. They were seen as a threat to the Football Association of England, which wanted to very much establish the men's game. All the men were coming back from World War One and starting to rejoin teams and things. And so the Football Association banned the use of their fields, and they also got all of the rugby teams and the cricket teams and just like every association that had a field. They said, if you let women play on your fields, we will fine you and you'll pay a price for that. And that really drove the game underground for 50 years. And it's just it's incredible to think about where that team might have been by now. They're doing very well. They just won the European Cup for the second time in a row, so they're doing great now, but they might have been doing great 50 years ago if that hadn't happened. And something very similar happened in Brazil and other places.
Well, you're right that violence and ridicule were tactics for control. How did that appear in the early decades? I mean, what did that look like?
I in the British press in the early days, it really looked like just mocking the idea that women should play at all.
Okay.
And I, and then a lot of sort of allegations that women who play football will never attract a man, that it might be compromising to their femininity, and then also a lot of very unsubstantiated medical claims about the effect of the game, that this might compromise their ability to have children, and just things that, that had no basis in fact, but helped to just spread fear among the public and turn the tide of public opinion against the game.
In your research, what did you find out or not find out about Black, Brown, and Indigenous women who may have played outside of official circles?
So I think that it's more the latter in terms of my research. Mm-hmm. Really, if you look at the U.S. women's national team, for example, it was very, very white for a long time. Brianna Scurry, she was the goalkeeper for the 1999er team that really kind of exploded awareness of women's soccer in this country. And she recently created a documentary called The Only. And the reference is that she was the only Black mm-hmm. face on most of her teams, like throughout her life. England has certainly also been called out for that same issue. And there are efforts underway there to diversify the game. And I think if you look at Brazil and Colombia and countries in South America, there's definitely a lot more diversity there. But it's interesting. Like if, I don't know if you've heard about any of this. I know you said you're not much of a sports fan, so this may not have come up, but it's interesting, for example, like on the men's side, the French team has a number of children of immigrants who play, who are Black mm-hmm. and Brown. And when the team loses, basically, there's a segment of the public that says, oh, they're African. And mm-hmm. when the team wins, that same segment will say, oh, they're French.
Yes, yes.
And yes. They'll claim them, you know, depending on the degree of success. And so
hold your thoughts. This is one of those times. We're going to take a quick break and we'll return. Heidi Smith connects women's soccer history to women's movement around the world and how race and class may have shaped who gets to play. You're tuned in to 411 Team. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Team, and we're back with author Heidi Smith discussing Play On, From Adversity to Advantage Through 140 Years of Women's Soccer. Heidi, I had to interrupt you, but you can continue your thoughts. I think we were talking about, you know, the men's soccer and how those people of color, men of color, if they win, they're good and they're French, but if they don't, then they're separated and they're African.
Yeah. And I mean, I have seen, so in the recent European Cup, the Women's Cup, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there was some really ugly racism directed at one player on the English women's national team. And they actually are prosecuting some of the people who were perpetrating that. So that's good. Okay. But I think that there are entire books that can and should be written just about race and class mm-hmm. in soccer overall and in the women's game, certainly. But I can't speak too much to that other than just things that I ran across in the course of my research.
Of course. You organized your book, which I thought was pretty cool, around soccer fouls. Why did you use the language of the game itself to title? I thought that was pretty clever.
Oh, thank you. Well, really, it was to save my sanity on one level. I started out with this general idea that women's soccer is changing the world. It's like, well, that's great, and it's a huge idea. And I wanted to, as I got into the research and the interviews, I just ended up with so much information that it needed some kind of organizing principle to make sense of it. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about how the fouls in soccer might translate into what I was learning. And actually, that seemed to work quite well. And so just to clarify what I mean, there's a rule in soccer called the advantage rule, also known as the play-on rule. And it says that normally, if you get fouled, the referee blows the whistle, play stops, you get a free kick or indirect kick. However, there's one circumstance where that doesn't happen, and that is if you've been fouled, but you're in a position to keep going and make an advantageous play or make a shot on goal, the referee will not blow the whistle, play continues, and they call that play on. Mm-hmm. So that was really the central metaphor for the book. And then the chapters are broken down by actual fouls in soccer, like obstruction, like dangerous play, like delay of game. And I tie those to these historic and current events that illustrate that, like the section on dangerous play includes the story of Iran and what's happening there. Mm-hmm. And then each chapter also includes three examples of women playing on and really achieving a remarkable results in spite of these issues.
Okay. How did Title IX reshape the game for girls and women in the U.S.?
Hugely, absolutely hugely. So I am a product of Title IX. I was 6 years old when it passed, and my generation of women was the first generation to grow up with equal opportunity to play sports. And we certainly did. And I think with soccer, because it was kind of under the radar, because it was not like football or baseball, we really grew up with it right alongside the boys. There wasn't so mm-hmm. much of a distinction. But just the number of girls, I don't have the exact numbers at my fingertips, but what I, so yeah, don't quote me on this, but okay. What I think I remember is that before the passage of Title IX, there was something like 19,000 girls playing any kind of organized sport in the US. And then after it passed, that number went to 230,000, and that's where it stayed. So it's definitely had an impact.
Mm-hmm. What about media coverage, or shall I say maybe the lack of it? How would you say that it has shaped public attitudes about women's sports?
That's an interesting question, because it's kind of a double-edged sword. In the past, we talked about ridicule, and that was certainly one way that the media talked about women's soccer. Another way, a common kind of attitude toward it in the 1940s and right up until recently, was objectification, to really sexualize players. And that happened in Brazil in the 1940s. It was really like, come watch a bunch of women running around in shorts, and that's the focus of the game. But then even as recently as the 99ers, which that's the 1999 Women's World Cup team for reference, the number one word used to describe them was babe. And then the second most common term in the media was girls next door. And the latter was really like, just to make them seem approachable and accessible and not too threatening and not too outside of social norms. But it also really diminished who they were and their achievements as athletes. Where we are now is just, it's been incredible. There are so many former players now who have podcasts. The people who are calling games are really talking about the games and doing in-depth analysis. They're not just talking about how someone looks, which is still happening in Japan, unfortunately, and a few other places. But they're really talking about strategy and tactics and the sport itself. So we have made some significant progress there.
Well, when you look around, even globally, not just limiting it to the States, where are girls gaining ground the fastest? And I guess the flip side of that would be, where are the barriers still the strongest?
Interesting question. I think one place I would certainly point to is Mexico. Mexico, until very recently, there were significant cultural barriers to girls and women playing. It just was not considered socially acceptable and not really supported. But now the Mexican Football Federation has invested a great deal of money into growing the game and encouraging girls to play at younger ages and just creating a pipeline for the women's national team. And there is just a real surge of support and investment and media coverage happening there that I certainly would not have predicted, like even 5 years ago. And that is incredibly encouraging, because other countries who have similar attitudes could certainly follow suit. Mm-hmm. At the same time, in terms of barriers, well, there definitely are cultural barriers, just depending where you're from, where it's just absolutely not seen as acceptable. And even if it is, women are really struggling to get paid. So, for example, the Nigerian women's national team, the Jamaican women's national team, the Colombian women's national team have all really struggled to even get paid at all by mm-hmm. their federations mm-hmm. for years. So that's a barrier, and that's like a systemic barrier coming from those federations. Mm-hmm. But encouraging signs in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The progress of women's sports reflects somewhat the progress in society, I would say. I'd agree with that. And I think you've noted that several times in your book. Yet, as with the women's movement, I mean, we still have to go back to that whole culture and race thing. Women of color were frequently excluded and faced double discrimination. How do you see at this point, from where you sit, your perspective, race intersecting gender at all across this whole history? How do you see it? What do you see?
I see a couple of things. I mean, I think thankfully, like, the U.S. women's national team at this point is way more diverse than it mm-hmm. ever has been. And mm-hmm. And that's a good sign. I guess, again, I think that in like places in England, for example, they're starting to make a real effort to go into communities where they typically haven't been looking for players. Mm-hmm. But I think that's essential. I think that one issue I would say is affecting all of this is there's been less of a focus on urban communities and and this is more of a class issue, I guess, mm-hmm. but people are definitely getting priced out of the game. Like, youth players are getting priced out of the game. And that is a problem. So I think just where the national teams at the youth levels and all levels are looking for players is very much an issue that mm-hmm. intersects with race and class, I think. Mm-hmm. And so just to be aware of where are you looking, who are you leaving out, where are you not looking, I think is important.
from that perspective, what role do you feel that the media plays? I mean, in reinforcing or challenging these divides that we're talking about. I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, because I think the media and how they depict and how they describe and all of that does play a role. But I'm just wondering how you see it. I mean, from your perspective, how it, does it reinforce? Is it challenging these divides? Do you think the media plays a role? Maybe it doesn't play a role. Well, it has to play a role somehow.
Well, this is not going to exactly answer your question, I don't think, but I will. This is what comes to mind. One of the things that I learned about sponsors is that when it comes to women, sponsors are way more likely to drop female athletes than male athletes over really small infractions. And anything that kind of challenges traditional ideas of what's acceptable for women, that they get punished. They get punished quicker and more severely. And then if you add race into that equation, it's even more so. And so like someone like Serena Williams gets just punished by the media for things that a white male player would not. So it's true of sponsors, it's true of the media, and it's true of fans. And I think that the what the media can do is just have way more diverse newsrooms that are covering these games.
Yes,
and that is where they can really make a difference.
That's what I was thinking, that you know, they just need to diversify their whole perspective, and by doing that, they would include more people, women of color, on their side in the media. Exactly. So, okay.
Yep.
You know, when we talk about, I don't know, women's athletics, or particularly we're talking about women's soccer, do you think we could say that women's soccer has been both athletic and political?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Definitely. Definitely. Especially within the last, I would say, the last 10 years. How long has Megan Rapinoe been around?
Yeah.
I mean, it's political in its very nature, because it's just, it's challenging what's okay socially for women and girls to do. And it, in that sense, it always has been political. And then I think just with the equal pay fight that the U.S. women's national team went through for the last 30 years, people had all kinds of opinions and judgments about that. And yet it was just an issue of fairness. And so, yeah, that's happened. And then more recently, the team has been... members of the team have been taking a knee during the national anthem and things. And that, if I mean, to what degree you were aware of the whole real just battle between Megan Rapinoe and Donald Trump.
I am aware of that.
Like that. Yeah, all that. So
that's what made me ask the question. I was really thinking of her, and that's what spawned it. You mentioned that sexism just looks different depending on the decade. What does it look like today?
We're going to wade into some waters here, but today I kind of feel like it's, well, you've got the whole issue of trans rights and all of these bills being passed to, in theory, protect women's sports. But the people that are passing those have never demonstrated an interest in women's sports ever before. And So I feel like that's, I mean, that's not exactly what you're asking about, but I think that they're just, that is certainly a battle that's being fought today. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's still, it just depends where you are in the world right now. I mean, there are still female journalists who are getting assaulted on air, like in Brazil, and even at the I think it was the World Cup that was in Russia that happened to a Swedish reporter. So there's kind of a full range of ways that it expresses itself today, but it's still definitely there
It's there.
and prevalent.
It's definitely there and that really answers it because I mean, it's just like racism. I mean, it's there. It might have a different head, but it's still there, So, yeah, and that basically was really what I was asking you about. When you think about examples of resilience, because, well, when you think about examples of resilience, what most inspired you doing your research? And I know you did an extensive research, and looking and talking to coaches and different folks. So I'm just wondering, and I'm not going to have you answer this question now because in a few seconds it'll be time for us to go to a break, but I'll pose the question now. Just what did you find about resilience that inspired you the most doing your research? Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I am talking with Heidi Smith, coach, soccer player, and we're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I am having a very informative conversation with Heidi Smith. She is an author, she is a former player, and she is a coach of women's soccer. And Heidi, again, we are just delighted to have you here. Before we went on break, I had asked you to kind of reflect and tell me some of the examples of resilience that you encountered during your research that you found most inspiring.
Well, one of the things that stuck with me was just a player who responded to getting cut from the U.S. women's national team, because that was I had the experience of being cut from my college team, and I just didn't I didn't I was not resilient. I did not handle it well at all. And Sam Coffey is a player that she's an excellent player, played for the Portland Thorns, and she was the last player cut right before the 2023 Women's World Cup. And she just kind of took a moment, went off by herself, and really just felt her feelings and was angry and was sad and was disappointed and all of that. And then she really looked at, how am I going to handle the rest of my summer? Because my team will be at the World Cup without me. And so what am I going to do? And she just made the decision that she would allow herself to feel her feelings, and then she would just figure out what she needed to do to be the best player she could possibly be. And she did that, and she worked with her coach like the whole summer, and then she was right back on the national team and won the Olympics with that team the following year. So that was a great story of someone just having an attitude in the face of real disappointment that allowed her to keep going. That was one.
Well, we've been talking and talking and talking about your book, but share with us and the listening audience where one can access or purchase your book. I am talking with author Heidi Smith. Her book is Play On, From Adversity to Advantage Through 140 Years of Women's Soccer.
Well, thank you. It's right now it's available primarily on Amazon, and I will note that audiobook coming soon.
Okay.
So just keep your ear to the ground.
Well, it was, and it's a good read. I'll add that to it. It was a good read. I enjoyed reading it, and it was very, very informed. So I thank you for even writing it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, what does Play On mean to you personally? I mean, symbolically, what does Play On mean?
It really means it's not so much what happens, it's mm-hmm. what you do with it.
Okay.
It matters. Yeah.
All right. What, oh, so I asked you this. Why do, and I encountered this and learned this in the book, but why do girls and women need to understand how hormones impact injury and recovery and mental health? I'd like you to talk about that. I found that to be very interesting and informative.
Yeah, it's a huge topic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's more studied now than it ever has been, but there's still a lot of catch up to do in the medical community. So it turns out that hormone cycles have a real impact on a couple of things. One, your risk of tearing your ACL, where you're at in your cycle. You are way more at risk if you're a female of tearing your ACL at certain points in your cycle, because there's a direct correlation between just hormone levels and elasticity of joints.
Yeah, and let me interject that, because I know that I heard so many times that women tear their ACLs much more often than men.
Yes.
And so, so that connects, yes. So thank you. Continue. I just wanted to add that in there.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. That's absolutely right. And then what I learned, because that actually, so the U.S. Women's National Team has been working with hormone cycle trackers, and so have some club teams in England. So that's been kind of a known quantity for the last 6 or 7 years. But what I learned in my research was that hormone cycles also correlate to both the severity and the recovery rate of traumatic brain injuries. And so women experience those differently than men also. And hormone levels also very much relate to how, like, depending on where you are in your cycle, the likelihood of experiencing depression and anxiety. And so these are things that I wish I'd known 40 years ago. That would have been really useful. But I think that girls really need to learn about these things, because you can do something about it. There are things with diet, with sleep, with meditation, there are things you can do to support yourself. But if you don't know what you're dealing with, you're not going to learn.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that was really very informative. So I appreciate you doing that, or including that in your book. When you look at just women's sports and the position of girls and women in the game, what gives you hope about the next generation?
A couple of things. I mean, right now we are seeing this absolute explosion of interest and investment and media coverage in women's sports. And like with the WNBA, more than half of the fans now are men and boys. We're just at this incredible time in history. We've got like the first sports stadium built solely for women in Kansas City. And now I think there's a new one for the WNBA. So that is all incredibly hopeful, and I couldn't have foreseen that even 10 years ago. And I also really like seeing, we've got athletes coming in today who are just, they're expecting to be treated well. It's not even occurring to them that they would not have equal pay, or that they wouldn't have equal playing conditions, or just, so some of the battles that have been fought seem like we're past that. We're on to whatever the next thing is, but some of these are, they've been won, and that's great.
Well, what about the fans? What steps can fans and institutions take to make soccer more inclusive? And I mean, not just across gender, but across race and across culture. Are there positions or things that you think fans can do, institutions, positions institutions can take?
I think that in youth sports, just to really, if there's anything that you can do in your own community to work on the issue of families getting priced out of participation, that is a real problem. It is a systemic problem, but I think that in communities, maybe that's the place to start working on it. I think that, again, like U.S. soccer, any national federations, they have youth teams going all the way down to like U11 in some cases. And just, again, looking at where are you searching for players and where are you not? And just really being aware and having a strategy, like making sure your strategy is inclusive. And then I think on an international level, people putting pressure on FIFA, which is the governing body, the world governing body for soccer, to turn around and put some pressure on the Iranian government to do something about allowing women into stadiums in not just a token way, and to recognize the Afghan women's national team, which is in exile in Australia. We have a World Cup coming up next year, and there will be a lot of eyes on FIFA. So that's a great time to turn up the heat on them a bit and say, hey, do something about this, because they can and they're not.
Okay. In these last few minutes, I got a couple of questions I'd like to have you respond to. Talk about the culture of silence and abuse in women's sports.
So I thinking about just thinking about the NWSL, there was a scandal that really was kind of rocked the National Women's Soccer League a number of years ago. And it was just the prevalence of both like verbal and psychological and sexual abuse in the game. And one of the issues there was that this was the third women's league that had been attempted in the United States. And so women really wanted it to succeed. The two prior had failed. So there was a lot of pressure on the players to make it work. And when these issues surfaced, they didn't feel like they could say anything because they didn't want to jeopardize the league. And so they kept silent. It just put them in a really impossible position. And then, of course, everything came out and there was this huge investigation. And I think things are a lot better now there than they were. But there are also things happening around the world where they don't have the same level of support. So things are better here. And I think they're getting better, but we still have work to do.
What about, how do you feel about the call for accountability and the call for change? I mean, where does that stand? What do you see from where you sit happening with that?
What I see, there's a lot of emphasis now on safe sport. There's a whole national organization for that. I think there's an international one as well. And the focus there is really athlete safety and having safe playing environments for players of all ages. And I think that is a real, it's a positive step. I think what needs to happen there is that coaches need to be brought along with it in a way that isn't just making them wrong for the way that they've always been, because it is a real shift for some people to just change if they've been used to being able to yell forever. It's like, nope, can't do that anymore. but giving them strategies and things that they can do instead, and coming at it from a supportive standpoint, I think is important.
Well, that leads me to asking you some questions about coaching. What do you see as the unique challenges of female coaches? What do they face today? What are they confronted with?
So this may be a bit of a long-winded answer, so
no,
bear with
okay.
me. But one of the things that I learned that I think might be really useful for teenage girls, is this thing called the attribution gap. And bear with me, because this does tie into coaching.
Okay.
But attributions are really the stories that we tell ourselves about why we succeed and why we fail. And there are internal attributions, like I succeed because I'm really good at something, or I'm really intelligent, or whatever the case. And then there's external attributions. I succeed because I'm just lucky, because my boss likes me, because the sun was out. I mean,
yeah.
I'm exaggerating.
But I got you.
And so what gets really interesting is that men in general tend to attribute their successes to internal factors, like I'm intelligent, I'm good at this, and their failures to external factors, like, I'm just on a bad team, or that boss just doesn't like me. And with women and girls, it's the opposite. So they think of their successes as being because of external factors, not really in their control, and their failures as being on them. And this really leads to like imposter syndrome, which women have at much higher levels than men. And it also leads to women not applying for jobs that they're qualified for. And so this is a big factor when it comes to coaching in women's soccer, because the ratio of female to male coaches is way down relative to where it was in 1972.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and it's because women are just not applying for jobs that they are totally qualified for. They're sort of preemptively disqualifying themselves based on these attributions. And I think it's such an important thing for girls to be aware of, because I certainly do it. A lot of women that I know do it, and just attributing successes to things outside of ourselves and failures to internal factors. And to change that would be a great thing, to really get a little clearer on why we're successful and not be so hard on ourselves when we fail.
That makes all the difference in the world. Well, what about the history? As we close, I got a couple questions up, but I better decide which one I want to ask you first. What about the history of women's soccer can teach us all about tackling sexism, addressing it? What do you think?
A couple of things. I think that one of the real themes that I saw in this history is that women really work together to overcome whatever was in front of them. And I think of the U.S. women's national team negotiating with the U.S. soccer, and U.S. soccer was threatening to just, if they wouldn't work with them, they were going to go around the senior team and just play the under-19 team. And the senior team really got on the phone and called every single member of every youth team and said, we're all in agreement, we're not going to play unless they sit down and negotiate with us. And it worked. And they all did it together. And I think that togetherness was a huge part of why they were successful. So I think that is something people can take away. And just, I really hope that people see it as a template for what's possible in their own arena, because these issues are not confined to women's soccer. Like any woman in a traditionally male sphere will be dealing with these things. And look at where we are today with women's soccer. It is possible. So we can learn from this.
Okay. Well, it's time to close. Any closing words of wisdom you want to share right quick?
I can't think of anything. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Okay. I appreciate you doing your book, and it was very informative. So it is time out for 411 Teen. You've been listening to Heidi Smith. She's the author of Play On, From Adversity to Advantage Through 140 Years of Women's Soccer. Her work reveals the fight for respect on the field and reflects the broader struggles for gender and racial equity, and reminds us that inclusion is still a work in progress. Thanks to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place. Get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio at WFSU.org.